From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
If you've got elephant's ears or calla lilies or some jack-in-the-pulpits in your shade garden or maybe a philodendron indoors on your windowsill, you're well on your way to a collection of the plants called aroids. I don't know anyone with more of these diverse and curious creatures than today's guest, Tony Avent, who's here to tempt us to collect some, too. But first, these messages.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from Timber Press, the leader in fine garden books. The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder by bestselling author Marta McDowell. The revealing exploration of Wilder's connection to the landscapes of the American frontier is a must-read for Little House on the Prairie fans. From booksellers everywhere. Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden.
Aroids are some of the most popular perennials at Plant Delights Nursery, where they're a specialty and a particular passion of founder Tony Avent's. I kind of have a thing for them, too, so selfishly I'm extra delighted to have him on the line today to give us, well, to give me, a tour of the best of the bizarre bunch. Welcome back, Tony.
Welcome. Good morning.
Yeah. Well, I should first say congratulations, and I think a thank you for all gardeners, especially in the United States, for 30 years of Plant Delights Nursery.
Yes, it's pretty amazing. It seems like yesterday.
I know.
We're just very blessed by having an array of people out there who love wild and crazy and unusual plants.
Yeah. Well, your work has made such a difference, and I mean this most heartfelt, it's made such a difference to us as gardeners because, you know, it wasn't that long ago, back in ancient history when we were younger, that, you know, you really couldn't at the local garden center get anything unusual. And it was thanks to yourself and a couple of other longtime friends, you know, who made it possible for those of us gardening in all kinds of locations to try things, you know. So thank you.
Well, you're kind of most welcome.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure for us.
Yeah. So where I live, Tony, our native wildflower season kicks off someday, if the snow ever melts, with an aroid, which is skunk cabbage, yes, Simplicarpus.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think it ranges maybe like to Minnesota and into eastern Canada and down to maybe you in North Carolina even. Is that possible?
It does. There's actually a couple of native populations in the Raleigh area, and that's about as far south as it goes. So we're right on the southern end.
Yeah, so we have that in common. So what makes a plant like that? What makes a plant an aroid?
Aroids are plants that have sort of a funky little flower. For people that are most familiar with things like jack-in-the-pulpit or a peace lily inside or an anthurium, it has the two sexual parts. It's got a spathe and spadix. The spadix, if you look at an anthurium, is that long thing that sticks right out there. As it's it's sexual thing.
Uh-oh.
And then the spathe is the thing that wraps it up in a nice package that makes it really colorful. In anthuriums, they're red, and peace lilies, they're white, but that's called the spathe, and it's a modified leaf whose job is to protect it, the sex parts, so it does a very good job.
You know, every time we get on the call, a call to do one of these shows, Tony, you bring up sex in the first minute or two. I have been timing it, by the way.
Well, there's very few plants that actually don't engage in that.
I know.
If there were, we probably would not have many plants.
I know. So this unusual and it's which part is the flower technically, or is it? Do you know what I mean? Like,
well, it's what most people think of as a flower is actually an inflorescence.
Okay,
and it's made up of several parts. If you take a look at the thing that looks sort of like a finger, if you look down at the very base of that, you will see little tiny things, and those are actually the flowers, and they're either male or female, or both.
Okay.
And that's sort of an interesting thing about aroids is many of them are, I hate to bring it up again, but they're transsexual. They, especially in jack-in-the-pulpits. When jack-in-the-pulpits are young, they're male. They're weak. They're not able to reproduce. And then next year or the year after, as it gets stronger, it actually switches. It decides, okay, well, this year we're going to be a female. And then, of course, then it's looking for men to impregnate it, and then it'll have seed, and then the next year it'll go back to being a male.
Wow. I remember the last time we spoke, we were talking about ferns, and they have their own kind of weird sexual thing. And so this is sort of another unit in botanical sex education, thanks to Tony Avent, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but these are weirdos, these aroids. And where are they? I mentioned that we share one native species between my New York garden and your or region and your North Carolina one. Where are they located on the globe? Like, where do they grow?
Wow. Aroids are pretty widespread. Mm-hmm. There's about 3,700 species. Actually, a little over half of those are in the Americas, some in North America, some in Central America, and some in South America. And the majority of the rest are actually Asian. There are a few on the European continent, not very many. We found some down in the Mediterranean region. All the groups like the Arums, or lords and ladies, and many common names, the Arums are primarily European. So that's and they got and not only did they get Arums, they got the double Arums, which is a really obscure genus called Biarum.
Biarum. Okay.
And biarums occur in, like, really rocky, dry, horrible Mediterranean places where they get maybe 8 inches of rain a year. It's not where you would expect to see an aroid.
Right, knowing the ones that we're more familiar with, like the colocasias and alocasias or you know, it's not what we would expect.
No, because those love moisture, and the arums and the biarums are sort of the exact opposite. They like it just absolutely bone dry.
So let's take sort of a walk through history of your aroid obsession, because I infer from an article, I'm so mean to you, I'm sorry. I infer from an article on your website that it was maybe a native Jack in the Pulpit that was your first aroid. Is that right?
Probably was. I used to, being the antisocial type, I would spend all my time out in the woods as a kid walking around, and to see these fascinating plants that were just, they're very, I don't know, I'm the guy that used to watch all the old horror flicks and the things like that, and it sort of reminds you of something out of a horror flick. I always said it was a great way to get kids interested in gardening, is to get them started on aroids, because they're odd, and if you're a loner like I am, that you're sort of drawn to odd plants and odd people.
So you have in North Carolina and a lot of the East, I think, you have two native Aracema species. Is that right?
Actually, three.
I only have two here. Yeah.
Yeah, we have. Well, that depends on your taxonomist. There's actually a species called Aracema quinatum that is finally getting its due. A lot of people had just said, oh, it's just a five-leaf version of the three-leaf one. Well, it's not. It doesn't cross. It's a completely different animal.
We have our triphyllum. Is that right?
And quinatum. Then the dragon arum, Dracontium.
Right, and I didn't know that until I went to a lecture recently in my area at a local ecology center, and they were showing photos of some of the botanizing they'd been doing, and they were talking about some local populations of what they call the green dragon, that one. I didn't know we even had that here. So now, of course, I'm going to be, as soon as spring comes, on the lookout, you know, for it.
There you go. It's really neat that we've actually, a couple sites in South Carolina, found all three species growing together.
Wow.
Population, so that was really neat as a plant nerd.
So in the garden, there are some; those can be some spectacular ones, but there's some even more in the genus Aracema. There are even more spectacular ones. So take us a little bit through; give us a quick tour of that group of plants.
Well, of Aracemas, as you mentioned, we've got the three, and they are always excellent, and they are showy, but the really, truly showy ones are the Asian ones.
Mm.
And you really get into Japan, Korea, and China. You get things like the there's two groups over there, the ones we call Jack in the Pulpits, and then the ones that actually are called cobra lilies because they look like the head of a cobra. And that would be things like Erythema ringens, which is a very popular one. And then you get into the Himalayan ones. That's where a lot of the really neat cobra head ones occur. But those are generally at a higher elevation and don't like our hot summers down here. But
I have a spot that doesn't get hot summers.
Yeah, you do. Yes, you're a little cooler than we are.
Yes,
and,
yes.
They're really just a neat group, both the Jack in the Pulpit types and the cobra head types, and very easy to grow of both. But the colors really get into, you get more striping and more reds, and you get these very long tongues. I mean, tongues that, and it's basically an extension of either the spadix or the spathe. It can be 2 feet long.
And what does it do? It sort of, I mean, it sort of hangs down, and what does it do? Is it, does somebody crawl up it, or does something drip down it, or what is it, what are those for?
Well, exactly. I mean, the erythemas are pretty odd looking. If you're an insect and you come up and you see that, you're not quite sure what to do. But if you get this long rope and it's like, all right, well, that should be interesting. Let's climb up there. And of course, it's trying to lure it in to have sex with it.
Yeah.
And so it just follows this long rope up and crawls in, and next thing you know, it falls down the tube and it has to try to get out. And erythemas are very interesting because many of them that only have male parts will allow it to go around in circles, and then it will open up to allow it to crawl out. But if it's got a female in it, it will generally seal them in there where they have to actually die in there having sex.
Wow. I always wonder with plants that where the flower, quote-unquote, where it isn't your classic, you know, bright-colored, obvious-looking flower with a yellow center and all that kind of thing. I always wonder, you know, some of the plants like this that have these curious inflorescences, I wonder if the reason they're so sometimes lavishly marked, like you said, they have some of the reddish purple and silvery or white, you know, they have these other sort of like, you know, neon sign sort of devices.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that's what it is. It's like, hey, I know I don't look like a flower, but I am pretty attractive. Come visit me. I wonder if that's what some of that coloration is, too.
Oh,
you know?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's all plants that have flowers. They're trying to lure somebody in there to pollinate them, and they do that very well. In this case, it's more of the purples, the reds. It's just like their very own red light district.
Exactly.
Say, hey, we're open for business. Come on in.
Exactly. You mentioned one of the cobra lily types. You say ringens. I always thought it was ringens, but I'm never sure how to pronounce anything, but whatever.
Depends on where you are.
It gets big, right? Does it get big?
Yeah, those will get 2 feet tall and 3 feet across. It's really amazing plant, and we many of our trips we'll stumble upon those in the wild, especially in Korea, where they were just absolutely amazing. Just walk in the forest and see these. It looks tropical, but it's not. Clumps there among all the other wildflowers. It just looks so fascinating texturally.
Mm. So, kind of moving on, I mean, I went around my garden, sort of a mental trip, you know, trying to think about, well, how many aroids do I really have, you know, just because recently, the last, I don't know, 5 years or something, I've been adopting some of the ones that aren't quite hardy for me and growing them in pots, like the so-called voodoo lilies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to talk about those in a second, but in my, like, looking around to find out who else was an aroid to see if I qualified as a collector yet, I found that theplantlist.org, which is a great place if you want to know who's related to who botanically, Lemna duckweed is an aroid.
Well, depends on your taxonomist.
But the plant list, yeah. I'm just saying the plant list still says that, yeah.
Yeah, there's it's like a tug of war. It's like somebody wants to get as many families as they can. So the aeroid people latched onto them, and then the other people have now put them in their own family, the Limonaceae. So
yeah.
It's a great tug of war. But, yeah, they don't look like aeroids.
No, kooky, right?
It's like a golden club, a wonderful little native aquatic. It doesn't really look quite like you're thinking an aeroid would look.
No, not at all.
There it is.
Yeah. So about those voodoo lilies, and I have, I think, Sauromatums and also Amorphophallus konjac. I think those are the So I know around this time of year that I had better hurry down into the cellar and see what's going on, or it will announce itself what's going on with this smell of dead rotten meat at any moment, because they wake up sometimes in my cellar, even though I haven't watered them since last year. It's a problem living up here, and trying to overwinter things when you don't have proper facilities like you have at Plant Delight. So tell us about some of those so-called voodoo lilies. They're totally fun. I mean,
they really are interesting. And, of course, everybody knows the giant Amorphophallus titanum, because when it flowers, everybody goes to see it. They're very interesting. They're fly-pollinated. So they're like, okay, to get these flies in, what do we have to do? Well, they said, well, we'll smell like something rotting. And then they'd flies just pour in there and do their thing. They generally go dormant in the wintertime. They're generally not up for very long. You might have 3 to 4 months of growth where they look like little palm trees or big palm trees.
Yeah.
And then they die back to the tuber. When the tuber's dormant, it likes to be really dry, but they're so much fun. We had a lady write us 1 year from up in New Jersey, and she would keep them in the house, and she would store them somewhere and lock them up so nobody could find them. And every year her husband, when they started flowering, would go down and try to find the dead animals. And she just got the biggest joy out of this, not telling him what they were.
Well, it really does smell like that. It's awful. And even where they're not hardy, as I said, I mean, I think a lot of them are like, I'm a 5B zone. A lot of them are like 6A or 7s or warmer, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
But they're great pot subjects. And they're good for growing in containers.
They really are very easy, and you can just store them. You can store them in your dresser doors during the wintertime. The tubers are really interesting looking, and I've actually seen people do that. And then as long as you get them out, like you say, before they start stinking up the place.
Right, right.
They're really neat plants.
So looking nothing like those, really, the elephant ears, the so-called elephant ears. And I know some are colocasias and some are alocasias. Is there a quick way to tell them apart or what?
Yes, a pretty easy way. The alocasias, the new leaves face up with the point, and the colocasias face down.
Oh, Tony, why didn't you tell me that all those years ago?
Well, it's actually very easy. And of course, the only one that's bothered me, this one called a giant elephant ear, Colocasia gigantea, and it does the opposite. It faces up. So it was always the odd man out. But it turns out some folks now have done a study and with the DNA and all the modern tools and found out, well, it's not a Colocasia. And that's why it points up. It's actually a new genus or a resurrection of an old genus. It's a Lasiocasia.
Lasiocasia, okay.
So that's going to be a new one. So we can go back to our old rule, all colocasias, leaves face down, alocasias face up.
And do both like really moist, I mean, can both grow even standing in water or not?
Most can, yeah. There's a few of the alocasias that probably don't like growing in water, but the majority of them, yes, very moist, just very moist conditions.
Those must be popular because in the catalog, because I know so many of the beautiful leaf patterns and those like matte leaves of, I guess Mojito was the first one that I knew like that, and now there are so many others. You have some beautiful ones.
They really are an amazing group, and we've been very blessed to be able to work with some of the top plant breeders to sort of guide them and to say, if you could cross this with this, and they come up with these amazing things. And, yeah, the colors, the textures, and almost all of them are hardy down to 0 to 5 Fahrenheit. So you can really bring that tropical color and that tropical texture into a garden in a temperate climate.
Yeah. No, they're wonderful plants. High drama. So, I was sort of like doing a mental trip around thinking, well, what else do I have? And, you know, a lot of people might have calla lilies maybe stored up in the north at this time of year. I mean, that's another aroid, right?
Absolutely. Callas are amazing and much hardier than people realize. I mean, while they're not overwinter up in zone 5, they're certainly good down to 0 in the garden.
Yeah.
You've got two groups. You've got the winter growing, which is one called Aethiopica or Aethiopica, depending on where you're from, and that grows and flowers in the winter or early spring. And then you've got all the ones that are colored. You've got the yellows, the pinks, the reds. Now we've got purples and purple and whites. And those are the summer growers. And those really don't come up till around, for us, mid-May and then flower in fantastic cut flowers, all of them.
So I want to know about which ones you recommend if we are beginners at this group of plants, if we want to have a starter collection, for instance. Any that you'd, and whether the ones we've talked about or others or ones that we haven't talked about that you want me to be sure to look at?
Wow, it really depends on where you're located.
Mm-hmm.
So I just tell people to find something that fits your zone. And now, obviously, if you want to grow them in containers, you can grow those anywhere. I tend to like the oddest stuff, so I love the Amorphophallus. They're fascinating. One of my favorites are the, it's called the Pig's Butt Arum.
You made that up.
Yeah, of course. All common names are made up.
I know, I'm teasing.
It's a Helicodistrus. It's a Mediterranean plant. And when you see it in flower, it looks and smells exactly like the butt of a pig.
Nice. I didn't really know exactly what that looked and smelled like, but thank you for sharing.
Well, just imagine something that is rolling around in wet mud for a while, and that's a pig. But the flowers on that are so absolutely fascinating. So if you want to draw people in, I tend to like plants that will make people remember having seen them. And when you see a pig's butt arum in flower, you can never get that either smell or sight out of your out of your consciousness.
So constant conversation starters are your kind of thing.
Absolutely. And so all of them, when they're in bloom, the arums when they're in bloom are so amazing. The elephant ears, a lot of people don't realize elephant ears flower from midsummer till fall, and the flowers are absolutely delicious in smell, and they have that same flower like a peace lily would have.
Mm. So we just have a couple of minutes, and I've always wanted to ask you, because you really are not just a collector of, say, one thing. Some people, you know, have a collection in their homes or in their gardens of one thing, but you're a collector of many collections. I mean, you've got a lot of different interests, passions among plants. Before we run out of time, I just wanted to say, any thoughts to sort of offer in the form of, like, advocating for collecting for something, for specializing in something as a gardener? Do you know what I mean? Like, do you feel like it's helped, you know, it's formed you in some way?
Well, absolutely. Well, humans are natural collectors. We generally, it's just not plants. But that collection of plants tends to be, unfortunately, more of a male thing. So we'd love to have more people join us in collecting, because collecting, especially in one group where you're really focused on that, is a great way to do ex situ conservation. That's conservation out of the sight, because if we all believe that climate change is happening and always has happened and will continue to happen, preserving plants where they grow naturally is not actually the best idea. The best idea is to bring them into a garden, propagate them, and share them as far and wide as we can. And so our entire focus has been to take as many groups as we can, focus on those, bring them in, study them, and then get them out to people, because it's all about preserving that germplasm for the future of humans.
See, now I didn't even think of it that way. I didn't even think of the higher purpose. I mean, I guess I knew intellectually, but I didn't think of it right off the bat.
Gardeners are incredible at conservation, and we just need to encourage them to do more of that. So no more of this eat plants in your yard. Get as many things as you can in there, and then share them.
Yeah. Well, Tony, as ever, I'm always so happy to speak to you, and I guess an aroid order from me will be on the way now that now that you've told me about some more that I had never heard of. And thank you. And again, as I said at the beginning, thank you for 30 years of plant delights. It's been wonderful. And let's hear it for more, okay?
Thank you very much.
I'll talk to you soon again.
Have a great day.
Underwriting support from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/AwayToGarden. Away to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from Timber Press, the leader in fine garden books. The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder by best-selling author Marta McDowell. The revealing exploration of Wilder's connection to the landscapes of the American frontier is a must-read for Little House on the Prairie fans. From booksellers everywhere.
And I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon, too, I hope. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or facebook.com/awaytogarden, and happy gardening meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.